Hello, this is Dee with the Vermilion County News for July 9th, 2018. We'll begin our reading today with the front page article entitled Floating on a Breeze, Balloons Over Vermilion Ready for Liftoff by Brianna Kirkham. When it comes to putting on an event such as Balloons Over Vermilion, which attracts 20,000 plus spectators, it's the small details that help the hot air balloons take flight. This year, spectators from Vermilion County and beyond can enjoy balloons of all shapes and sizes, plus a plethora of entertainment on July 13th and 14th. Jim Anderson and Pat O'Shaughnessy are co-chairs for Balloons Over Vermilion, which is in its third year. The event followed a hiatus from the Balloon Classic that ended after 2001. We realized there was an entire generation that missed out on that opportunity, Anderson said. One of our goals, initially, was to reinstall the pride in this area and to show the young people of this community exactly what can be accomplished here in their backyards. Some of the planning takes place a year ahead of time, with some details finalized up until the 11th hour. Finding balloonists, vendors, sponsors, and performers is always ongoing. This C Balloons on 4A Balloons Prepared for Flight as last year's Balloons Over Vermilion. This year, spectators from Vermilion County and beyond can enjoy balloons of all shapes and sizes, plus a plethora of entertainment on July 13th and 14th. This year, are there several new features to look forward to, including a laser light show, a performance of the national anthem by Chicago Blackhawks performer Jim Cornelson, and an exhibit from Sharm Academy's award-winning archery team. There are also three new special balloon shapes this year, including two different dragons and a heart-shaped balloon. But Anderson said he's most excited about the enthusiasm of the returning pilots. This is only the third year of our event, and they carve it out of their calendar, he said. The person in charge of corralling all the pilots is dubbed the Balloon Meister. Joe Vincent was a pilot himself in the 1990s before retiring from the sport due to his arthritis. One of my most important duties is to get waivers with FAA, Federal Aviation Administration. We have to get rules waived so we can fly into targets and through certain airspace, he said. It's also a big task to get 35 pilots signed up, which co-host Dean Carlson and Larry Owen assist with. Vincent also keeps safety at the forefront of his mind, making the final call whether or not pilots can go up in the air. These balloons look really soft, but you have 90,000 cubic feet, and things can go south really quick if you aren't paying attention, he said. We won't fly unless it's absolutely perfect conditions. Additionally, they're dealing with an open and operating airport. Vincent said most airports shut down when hosting a balloon festival. We have to leave the runway open for those that have to work, he said. Others working to ensure BOV is safe for everyone include the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department, Bismarck Fire Department, FAA representatives, Vermilion County Emergency Management Agency, and OSF Pro Ambulance. And when it comes to crucial details, David Schnell and Doug Ahrens, who are directors of community development and the sanitation district, respectively, help with everything from parking to portable toilets, and that's according to Vincent. Similarly, heaps of volunteers help make sure everything runs smoothly for the balloonists, families, and performers. There's a volunteer spirit that seems to be built into the local DNA, Anderson said of the community. Volunteers may be so eager to help because BOV offers something for everyone. We say this BOV is for the kids, but we have a very broad definition of what that constitutes, Anderson said. The kids zone is located adjacent to where the balloons launch, giving them the best viewpoint from the ground. And of course, the bigger kids can enjoy the festivities from the beer tent. This year, the live entertainment and adult area is moved to the terminal tower. Most events, even during the course of the event, you think about what you could do next year. Anderson said, noting he takes suggestions from vendors, sponsors, and social media into consideration. He's also appreciative of the Julius W. Hegeler Foundation, who partnered with BOV for a 5-year commitment. That was extremely important to put financial footing in this community, he said. BOV organizers hope spectator turnout continues to grow. They had about 22,500 visitors last year and want to bring that up to 25,000 this year. Anderson said once people come out to the event once, they'll carve it out on their calendar year after year. All balloonists seem to agree. There's nothing that compares to the feeling of being up in the air in a hot air balloon. Being a lifelong resident of the area, you think you know the landscape until you get a broader sense, he said. It gives you a new appreciation. Our next article is entitled, Group Gives Scholarships for College Camps. Danville. As a thank you to the agricultural community, the Balloon Association of Greater Illinois, BAGI, offers scholarships to young people through the Vermilion County Farm Bureau. $500 awards are given to Farm Bureau members or dependents in 20 counties, according to Tom Fricke, information director with the local Farm Bureau. The local Farm Bureau processes those applications and then makes recommendations to the Balloon Association, which makes the final selection. Applicants must be college students in an agricultural-related field. Eligibility requirements can be found on the BAGI website. This program has been going on for at least 20 years, he said, and is not connected with the Balloons Over Vermilion event. Donna Carlton Vish, with Sunnyside Up Balloons, said, "We believe that since we often land in farm communities, it's a great way to give back to those who help us by allowing us to land on their properties. It's our way of saying thank you. Money for our scholarships is raised through membership dues and events, such as auctions." She said, "We're very proud we're able to do that. We have many fundraisers through the year. Balloon camps. Besides the scholarships, young people interested in ballooning are invited to apply for balloon camps, sponsored by the Balloon Federation of America. 2 scholarships to camp are provided every year to ages 13 to 18. They get a lot of hands-on experience," Carlton Vish said. "The camps are a good way to get young people interested in the sport so it can grow." Sydney Smith, 14, of Danville, had the chance to go to a camp in Wisconsin last summer, and she loved it. Unfortunately, the weather was bad that weekend, so she didn't get to take a balloon up. She learned various things, such as knowing about the airspace, respecting the landowners, identifying the different balloon types, and making your own balloon rather than buying one. Homemade is less expensive, but time-consuming. The students also inflated a balloon in a warehouse and did a safety check. Smith, who's homeschooled, said she's been flying most of her life, and her grandfather, Walt Rudy, in Ohio, is a pilot. "I've always loved it. It's a lot of fun," she said. She likes to take off early and enjoys the peaceful ride. In the winter, the balloon doesn't need as much heat from the burner, so it's quieter. She recommends ballooning to her friends and expects to continue it as she gets older. Sydney is the daughter of Shannon and Beth Smith. Camp applicants don't need to be a member of BAGI or BFA. This year, the camps will be held in Wapaka, Wisconsin, in June, and in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in July. The sponsorship pays for the tuition fee, but campers are responsible for their own transportation. Learn more at the Balloon Federation of America website. Here's a little bit of further information about contacting the group. Learn more at the Balloon Association of Greater Illinois website, www.bagiballoon.org. It also has a Facebook page. The Balloon Federation of America website is www.bfa.net. Its Facebook page is www.facebook.com/BFA.net. You may also contact Larry Owen at 217-304-0827, who is the scholarship coordinator. Our next article is entitled, China's tariffs on imports will hurt Midwest's farmers. By Ian Sheldon, CNHI News Service. China's 25% retaliatory tariffs on imports of U.S. soybeans may surprise most Americans, but to agricultural economists who study international commodity markets for a living, it was not at all unexpected. Even before the conclusion of the 2016 presidential race, trade analysts were weighing the possibility China might impose an embargo on U.S. soybean imports based on protectionist rhetoric from both candidates. Now that risk of a U.S.-China trade war is reality, American soybean farmers may be among the biggest losers. Soybeans are a crucial part of the global food chain, particularly as a source of protein in the production of hogs and poultry. In 2016, the U.S. accounted for $22.8 billion worth of global soybean exports, the most of any country. Its nearest competitor is Brazil, which exported $21 billion. The U.S. is the world's top producer of soybeans, with close to half of the market, followed closely by Brazil. The U.S., $22.8 billion, Brazil, $21 billion, Argentina, $3.6 billion, and Canada, $1.9 billion, Paraguay, $1.8 billion. China accounts for the lion's share of global soybean imports, of $34 billion, or two-thirds of the total. American exports made up about a third of that, or $12.4 billion, making soybeans the United States' second most valuable export to China after varieties of airplanes. China consumes about two-thirds of the world's soybeans, $34 billion. The European Union, $6.5 billion, Mexico, $1.6 billion, and Japan, $1.5 billion. Thailand, $1.2 billion. The importance of China as a market for soybeans is driven by an explosion in demand for meat in that country as consumers switch from a diet dominated by rice to one where pork, poultry, and beef play an important part. Chinese production of meat from the three animals surged 250% from 1986 to 2012, and is projected to increase another 30% by the end of the current decade. However, China is unable to produce enough animal feed itself, hence the need to import soybeans from the United States and Brazil. That's why the tariffs have tremendous potential to hurt farmers in Ohio, where soybeans are the number one agricultural export at $1.4 billion. China is the state's largest export market, and Ohio is just the sixth largest exporter of soybeans, after Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Indiana, and Nebraska, all of which will suffer from the tariffs. Not only do farmers stand to lose out by giving up market share to Brazilian farmers, but soybean prices will probably fall as well, hurting incomes and creating a double whammy for Midwest farmers. This is why the Chinese chose to place a tariff on U.S. soybeans in the first place. Farmers will hurt a lot, and soybeans are produced in states where many of them voted for Donald Trump for president. China's hope, presumably, is that farmers will lobby the administration to step back from the brink of a trade war, allowing U.S. soybeans to maintain its lead export position. Ian Sheldon is Ohio State University's chair in agricultural market, trade, and policy. His column was distributed by The Conversation, an independent news service, featuring commentary from academic experts. Our next article is entitled "Protesters Shut Down Chicago Freeway," The Associated Press, Chicago. Thousands of anti-violence protesters marched along a Chicago interstate on Saturday, shutting down traffic in an effort to draw attention to the gun violence that's claimed hundreds of lives in some of the city's poorest neighborhoods and pressure public officials to do more to stop it. Marchers chanted, "Stop the killing," and carried signs reading, "We need jobs," and other messages. Some stopped to scrawl on the road with chalk, "Enough is enough," and "Peace." Toward the front of the march, the Reverend Michael Flegger, who organized the protest, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson and the Reverend Jesse Jackson linked arms. The march took place along the northbound lanes of Interstate 94, known as the Dan Ryan Expressway, after a roughly hour-long standoff between police and the protesters. Illinois State Police, which had warned earlier in the week that any pedestrian entering the expressway would face arrest, said early Saturday that an agreement had been reached for protesters to march on a portion of the roadway. Officers and vehicles lined up, forming a barrier to keep protesters in two northbound lanes, allowing some traffic to pass in other northbound lanes. But Fledger and protesters insisted there was no agreement and they would shut down the entire northbound roadway, with Fledger noting, "The city closes major roads for parades and other occasions." The crowd began creeping into other lanes, a situation Fledger said had the potential to become dangerous. Illinois State Police, which has jurisdiction over expressways, announced around 11:30 a.m. that they were shutting down all northbound lanes of the expressway. Protesters then began walking northbound along roughly a 1.5 mile, 2.4 kilometer route. "Today we got their attention," Fledger said afterward. He said the next step is accomplishing the actual goal, an aggressive plan to address the violence. Among the demands the protesters listed were more resources, jobs, and better schools for their communities, as well as stronger gun laws. "There is a historical significance to marching along the Dan Ryan Expressway, a roadway some believe was built in the early 1960s to separate white communities and poor black ones. To the west of the new interstate were Comiskey Park, home of the White Sox, and neighborhoods such as Bridgeport, home to then Mayor Richard J. Daley and his clan. To the east rose the Robert Taylor Homes, a high-rise public housing complex that became notorious for its violence. It was the kind of racial and economic segregation that still exists in Chicago today." Chicago police said the city had 252 homicides and 1,100 shootings in the first 6 months of this year, a decrease from the same period last year. But those crimes have been heavily concentrated in predominantly black, low-income neighborhoods. Our next article is entitled OSF Healthcare Warns of Possible Scam for the Commercial News. OSF Healthcare has received information from several of the hospitals in its ministry where patients or caregivers have received calls from what appears to be an OSF Healthcare caller. Caller ID. The callers have asked for bank account and personal information. OSF Healthcare wants the public to be aware these calls are taking place. Those who receive such a call, particularly if you had no interaction with the department at an OSF Healthcare facility, hang up. If you are concerned the call may be legitimate, call the OSF location back using the main switchboard number at that facility. Ask the operator to connect you to a specific department. Do not call the number provided during the original call. Those who receive such calls are encouraged to report them to your local police department. And now we'll turn to our obituaries. The first is Anna Marie Ann Klaus, 95, of Hoopston, passed away at 7:05 a.m. Thursday, July 5, 2018, at Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Living in Hoopston. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. to noon Tuesday, July 10, 2018, at Anderson Funeral Home, 427 East Main Street, Hoopston. Funeral services will follow the visitation and will begin at noon Tuesday at the funeral home, with the Reverend Tom Cece officiating. Burial will follow in East Lynn Cemetery, East Lynn. Next, Marilyn Montgomery, 79, of Westville, passed away at 8:48 a.m. Sunday, July 1, 2018, at Hawthorne Inn, Danville. A celebration of Marilyn's life will be at 6 p.m. Monday, July 9, 2018, at Sunset's Houghton Leisure Funeral Home, 200 East West Street, Georgetown, with Pastor James Blue officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, prior to her service at the funeral home. She will be laid to rest in Crown Hill Cemetery, Ridge Farm, at a later time. Next, C.J. Newell, 76, of Dallas, died at 11:46 a.m. Wednesday, July 4th, 2018, at OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leakin Son Funerals Home, Danville. Next, Tania Williams, 20, of Danville, died at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 5th, 2018, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leakin Son's Funeral Home, Danville. Next, Carl Austin, 52, of Danville, died at 8:54 a.m. Friday, July 6, 2018, at Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leakin Sons, Danville. Next, Lance W. Gerton, 75, of Salt Lake City, formerly of Oakwood, passed away at 9 p.m. July 3, 2018, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A celebration of life service will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, July 12, 2018, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center, 3940 North Vermilion Street, Danville. The Reverend Samuel Johnson will officiate. Burial will be in Stern Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, July 11th, at the funeral home. Jewel Kirkpatrick, 92, of Westville, died at 1:50 a.m. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, at Pleasant Meadows Senior Living in Chrisman. Private burial will be in Lithuanian National Cemetery, Westville. Rortvet Funeral Services in Tilton is in charge of arrangement. Helen Anderson, 93, of Danville, died at 5:57 p.m. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leak and Sons Funeral Home in Danville. Mary Ruth Cox Dukes, 89, of Kingman, Indiana, and formerly of Oakwood, Illinois, passed away at her daughter's home in Tilton, Illinois, Friday, July 6, 2018. Visitation will be at Sanders Funeral Care, 203 South 1st Street in Kingman on Sunday, July 15, 2018, from 4 p.m. Indiana time until the time of the celebration of life service at 7 p.m. Indiana time, with Pastor Steve Crum officiating. Burial of cremains will be on Saturday, July 21, 2018, at 10 a.m. Illinois time at Oakwood Cemetery in Oakwood. Sanders Funeral Care entrusted with care. Douglas A. Gooden, 64, of Greenwood, passed away on July 5, 2018. The family will be holding a private service at a later undetermined date. Arrangements entrusted to G.H. Herman Greenwood, Indiana Funeral Home. Donald H. Van Allen, 81, of Danville, went to be with the Lord at 10:30 p.m. Friday, June 29, 2018, at his home, surrounded by his wife and family. A celebration of Don's life will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, July 9th, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center, 3940 North Vermilion, Danville. Officiating will be Pastor Patty Wise. A visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest in Sunset Memorial Park. Ronald J. Cotapish, 80, passed away July 4th, 2018, at OSF in Urbana. Please join in for a celebration of life Tuesday, July 10th, 2018, at the Elks Lodge, number 332, at 421 North Vermilion Street, Danville, from 5 to 7 p.m. In lieu of flowers, please make a donation to the charity of your choice. Latrey Reed, 21, of Danville, died at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 5th, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leakin Son's Funeral Home in Danville. And Gary Welker, but there is no specific date listed for the date of his death. Rortvet Funeral Services and Crematory Tilton is assisting the family. Now we'll move on to another article entitled New Owners Discuss Plans with County City Leaders by Tracy Crane. This is regarding Bressy Tower, Danville. The new owners of Bressy Tower met with local city and county officials this week to discuss their plans for renovating Danville's tallest building. "We had a wonderful discussion," Danville Mayor Scott Eisenhower said, of his more than hour-long discussion Thursday with the new owners and Vermilion County Board Chairman Mike Marin. According to a quitclaim deed recorded Tuesday at the Vermilion County Administration Building, Chris and Jerry Collins are the new owners of Bressy, a vacant, century-old, 13-story former office building that towers above downtown Danville's other structures at the intersection of Vermilion and Main Streets. Eisenhower said they had a great discussion about what types of amenities would be included in the project, but he did not want to disclose details of exactly what the couple wants to do with the property. The News Gazette contacted the Collins by electronic message more than a week ago. Jerry Collins responded that they aren't quite ready to be interviewed just yet. Eisenhower said he was impressed with the Collins' desire to see the area around Bressy developed in a way that would be compatible with their planned project. He said they discussed possibly leasing the city's parking garage on Walnut Street. I was impressed that they were looking more holistically at the downtown area rather than just their property, he said. I'm excited about the plans they have and believe that the project would be incredibly beneficial to the downtown as well as the whole community, and very hopeful that they will be able to bring these plans to fruition. Marin said he has talked with the new owners, who he said are interested in the county selling them the vacant Vermilion County Courthouse Annex, which is literally connected to Bressy Tower. All of the county offices in the annex finished moving earlier this year to the new Vermilion County Administration Building in the former U.S. Federal Courthouse on Vermilion Street. Before proposing the sale, Marin said he wants to be sure that the new owners of the Bressy have a substantial plan for the tower renovation and financing in place. I don't want to just hand it off to someone who just leaves it as a problem for the city, he said, adding that if their plan is solid, selling the annex would be a great option for the county. It would save us a lot of money. Marin has said that the county might have to pay to tear down the annex if there were no viable alternatives for its use. The annex and Bressy share infrastructure like plumbing, which complicates taking down one building and saving the other. The previous owner of Bressy, Scotty Porter, executive director of the Alabama-based nonprofit Historic Restoration, Inc., announced in early June that he had sold the building, but he didn't reveal the new owners, their plans, or how much they paid. Porter, whose organization had acquired Bressy in October as a donation from Kentucky-based Forged Group, with the hopes of restoring it. The Forged Group ended up with Bressy in 1993 when it purchased a radio station, WIAI, which was housed in the tower at the time. The company later sold the station and, in 2006, informed Bressy office tenants that it was closing the building. It has been vacant ever since. Last October, the city filed a lawsuit against Porter's Limited Liability Corporation, pressuring him to immediately repair Bressy's terracotta facade, which has deteriorated over the last two decades. Pieces have fallen to the ground, creating a liability issue for the city and the county. Eisenhower said the Collins, Marin, and he had discussed the exterior and the urgency of addressing it. They were both very amenable to that and suggested they have already had conversations with appropriate firms to complete that task, Eisenhower said. Crops and produce sought for donation. OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center and Faith in Action are seeking donations of produce from gardeners and farmers who have some crops to share. Donated produce will be made available to older adults who either can't garden or don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. This has been Dee with the Vermilion County News for July 9th, 2018. I hope you have a great day, and I look forward to reading with you again soon.